What do you feel like doing tonight?
I don't know, Ange. What do you feel like doing?
Oh, what do you feel like doing tonight?
I don't know, Ange. What do you feel like doing?
We're back to that, huh? I say to you, what do you feel like doing tonight? And you say back to me, I don't know what you feel like doing tonight. Then we wind up sitting around your house with a couple of cans of beer watching a hit parade on television.
Let's go to movies.
Director!
This is a frightened city.
Wait for it! Director! Cut!
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for a new film talk show, Film Sociology, with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Schizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yes.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Happy New Year, film lovers. Welcome to 2010, and welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. It's just you and me today, and since no movies opened this week, next week will be my best of 2009 chat with Ed Johnsonot of Nouveau News Weekly. So today is a greatest hits package. I'm going to highlight three interviews that happened in the first season of Film Sociology. So let's get cracking. We're going to start things off with a conversation I had about 2 months ago with Academy Award-winning actor F. Murray Abraham. This was to preview his appearance at the opening season for the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. Here we go. Well, first off, I guess I should... How should I address you?
Your Majesty.
My liege, I was thinking, but...
my name is... I'm half Syrian, half Italian, and it's hard to please both sides of the family. So my father's name is Frederick, and my name is Frederick, but I decided to use an F because the Syrians call me Farid, and the Italians call me Federico. So with the F, I pleased everybody.
All right, so F. Murray.
That's fine. Murray is just dandy.
Murray, okay.
Now do I call you?
Matthew.
Okay, Matthew.
And so obviously you played a lot of Wasp, obviously, with your background.
I played a lot of Wasp. Yeah, I don't think I ever played a Wasp in my life.
How did you get hooked up with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra?
I've been doing this for years, all over the world.
This particular piece?
And I think that... This particular piece, you know what we're doing, right? The Copland piece?
Lincoln's Portrait.
Yeah, it's just, it's very meaningful to me. And the first time I ever did it was here in town with the New York Philharmonic. And I was carried away. I really was very moved by those words. And I had done some studying. I had played a Lincoln once, believe it or not, speaking of Wasps.
A Continental?
A Continental Lincoln? No. You know, that was a great-looking car.
Yes, it was.
It was a wonderful car at one time.
Back when cars were a piece of art.
Well, yeah, you're talking to a car fiend. I agree with you. When you could we could spot cars by the sound of their mufflers. They were that individual. I don't know if you know that.
I grew up in an automotive town up in Michigan, so yeah, I remember those days.
Where were you, around Flint?
Yes, I grew up in Flint. Got out with all my fingers.
Yeah, well, my people were steel workers in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
We made the steel. I don't know. You have your own steel mills in Indiana. I know that.
Well, not really. Gary's a wasteland nowadays.
Well, have you been to Flint lately?
Yes.
I mean, it's really too bad. It's a depressing thing. A friend of mine who lives there, when I did a concert in Detroit, it was one of these concerts. Only this was an interesting concept. A concert. It was... I'm trying to think. It was, you know Stravinsky's Story of a Soldier.
Yes.
Rather, his music for it.
Right.
Well, Vonnegut has written an adaptation. He said that the original story has nothing to do with reality. He said the music does, the discordant, the wonderful, driving, strange, and absolutely brilliantly original music. I worship Stravinsky. This is a tough piece of literature and writing. He hated war, Vonnegut did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extraordinary. I don't know why it's not done more often instead of the original. But I was doing it in Michigan, and a friend of mine took me out for a ride out by the lake to have a nice fish dinner. And I saw all those beautiful mansions, all for sale.
Yeah. Now, how often do you get to do pieces like this with symphonies?
Well, it's whenever I get calls, and if I'm not making a flick, or if I'm not doing a play, I jump at the chance, because I don't know how to explain it. If you have a chance to be on the stage with an orchestra, you have to do it. You have to arrange it if you have any pull anywhere. Just to be on the stage with them while they're working out.
Now, is this a piece where it's in between the songs, or they're playing under you as you're reading?
It's going to be between and during.
Ooh.
It's just thrilling.
That's got to be a rush.
Oh, I can't begin to tell you. And I've worked with some of the greatest in the world. And it's thrilling. I mean, really thrilling. It's like a different kind of a thrill, because there's no... It's not an intellectual activity. It's far beyond that. It's really deeply... It's visceral, but at the same time, it's transporting. It's transcending. Great.
Well, it's interesting, because when you do a film, unless the director pumps music onto the set during a shot, I mean, that's one thing. But to be able to have, I mean, you, the soundtrack is behind you.
Yeah, the only problem with it, I mean, the danger, not the problem, is that if you miss your cue, you're in trouble, because the orchestra doesn't try to vamp and catch up. It's hard to do with 90 pieces,
it's,
you know.
It's not a jazz combo.
It's great. It's also a completion of sorts in terms of an actor, because there are things that an actor in the classical works, for example, any Shakespeare, any musical piece of work, Moliere, for example, or even some of the beautiful music that's in Tennessee Williams, you're never going to be able to achieve what music achieves. You try to, vocally and also spiritually, but you can't accomplish what Mozart does. It's just a different thing. But the idea that you can combine them, it's a kind of a gift, I must tell you. It's like a little present. And the whole thing is, I'm sure... Because I did that movie so many years ago, Amadeus.
25.
I mean, can you imagine that thing is still alive? People still love it.
Yes, I can actually. I was 14 when that film came out. I remember being the youngest one in the theater by about 30 years, and think not only did this film introduce me to and open my mind to classical music, but I went, "Wow, who is this guy?" You know, the guy from Animal House is great, but who is him? Who is he? And that was, for a lot of people, that was the world introduction to F. Murray Abraham.
Yeah, it was a treat. It was a gift. The problem is, of course, it's not being able to do another one like it, you know?
No, Amadeus 2. The final years.
Well, my son said that there should be a sequel where Amadeus is where Mozart's son grows up and wants revenge. He wants to call it Amadambo. Anyway,
don't give Michael Bay any ideas. Now, when you filmed that, did you do the young Salieri first or the old one first?
The old one. I did all the old stuff first. We did it in 3 weeks.
Wow. How much time on the chair for makeup?
4 hours, 4.5 hours each morning.
Were you able to sleep?
Well, I was pretty intense. I don't know how to tell you. I'm a pretty intense actor anyhow, but I was completely dedicated to that, and I lived alone when I was in Prague to be away from the company. It was all completely focused. I think the biggest mistake I made, if you can call it a mistake, is expecting to, from that point, do that kind of work for the rest of my life in film. That's kind of naive.
Well, what was the silliest script you got after winning the Oscar?
Oh, gee, there were so many that I refused. I should have done them just for the money, if not anything else. But they were just silly. They made me out to be a villain. I don't think Salieri is a villain. Well, I think he's a real human being.
Well, Carl Malden said bad guys don't wake up thinking they're bad guys. They got a job to do.
That good old Carl Malden. I just saw One Eyed Jacks not long ago. He was
in that. Yeah, I just watched Baby Doll. Not a film to watch with your wife, but
that's another good performance. Was that Kazan?
Yes. It's funny you mentioned intensity. My daughter, she's 7, and she said you were intense in Muppets from Space.
Isn't that great?
She's like, you're talking to him? I went, yes, that's part of Daddy's job.
Oh,
believe it or
you're
not.
Kidding.
No.
That's so flattering. Isn't that a great age?
Yeah. She's. It's funny. My wife is an actress, and any role that my wife plays, my daughter wants to play. So she refers to herself as Baby Gertrude and Baby Parthy. And last year, Lynn got to do Lear, and Emma said, I'm Baby Goneril. And we went, no, you're not. No, no, no. That's wrong, and on so many levels.
Medea.
Yeah, don't give her any. I directed that, but she doesn't remember, thank God.
You're an actor.
I try. My wife is equity. I'm independent. And if it's a choice between my wife's guaranteed equity money and or my vanity projects, I let Mrs. work.
Works the work. So. I mean, you can see that for some of the films I've done. I mean, after a while, you think, well, I'm not going to wait anymore for a good film. I've got to make The Rent.
Well, even
after a while, you think, oh, God, do I have to do this? And you do.
But I think even films that maybe there's not high-profile roles, but when I see you in something like Insurrection and Surviving the Game, I'm like, well, he's going to be fine. He knows what he's doing.
Well, I love the idea of people asking me, like, well, why are you doing those movies? Well, that's kind of a dumb question. I mean, you do what you have to do. But if they asked me to do other films, I would do them. But it seems to me that my life is really revolves around the theater here in New York, and I do films when I have a break from the theater.
As opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, but it's a nice life. Mm-hmm. Just one of those. I love Shakespeare, and you can't live on Shakespeare, not in New York anyway. I don't think you can anywhere. I mean, I don't think they pay very well.
Mm-hmm. Was it after Amadeus that you wound up doing a lot more classical theater?
Well, yeah, I was doing it before, but afterwards it was amazing how it kind of guarantees your work life. It's hard to believe. I mean, I'm a good actor, but there are a lot of good actors around. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not selling myself short, but you know what I'm talking about. You got to have some luck in this business.
Sure.
And I've had some luck, but ever since I won the Academy Award, I've been working practically every day. It's just been wonderful stuff off-Broadway, experimental stuff with Richard Foreman and with Tom O'Horgan and, gosh, I guess everybody in town. I've really had a great time. And I'm going to continue having a great time.
Well, it seems like it's been, from an artist standpoint, to be able to do stage and screen and voiceover and narration, so you're not stuck in a rut. You're not stuck doing a soap or a sitcom for years and years and years.
Yeah, it's the best.
And one of the things that's always was cool for me, especially after seeing Amadeus, was you were one of that guys. And when I saw your earlier work, I'm like, oh, my – I was a caffeinated 15-year-old. So I'm like, oh, it's the Amadeus dude. And – Scarface and Serpico and Sunshine Boys. It was one of those, I have to go back, and this is before the internet, I'm like, I have to go back and find out what else this guy has done to lead up to this.
Oh, you got to take a look at the Ritz.
Yes, I saw the Ritz at too young of an age. I should revisit it again now that I'm more semi-mature.
Well, it works better on the stage, I think, but it's not a bad picture. It is great.
Yes. And I especially liked your work in Mighty Aphrodite.
Oh, thanks. That was fun.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you couldn't have seen any of my stage work, because I...
Well, you're still doing some stage work, right? I just need to go east.
I've been doing Ethan Coen's plays. Those are pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know anything about them.
What are some of the plays?
Well, he's written 6 plays, and I've been in 4 of them.
So you're one of the community players.
They're 6 one-acts, short pieces, and it seems like we've got a hookup, and it's great, because they're funny, and they're brief, and they're... What did Chekhov call his one-act plays? Vaudevilles? That's kind of what these are.
Right. Now, did I see you just completed a picture of Barbarossa?
Yeah, it should be coming out next month.
This isn't a remake of the Gary Busey, Willie Nelson Western, right? This is completely different?
Gosh, I didn't know about that.
1982.
No, I don't know that picture. I know Gary. We worked together.
Mm-hmm.
In Surviving the Game.
Yes.
He's, we really had a good time, he and I. I mean, you've heard stories about him, and I...
Yeah, we've seen him on TV, yeah.
I didn't see any of that stuff. I mean, we had a great time. We became quite close.
I mean, the guy doesn't get an Academy Award nomination for nothing.
That was a wonderful performance.
Yes. What is this Barbarossa about?
It's a historic character who actually tried to unify Italy, but under his command. Barbarossa came in from the north and tried to take it over. And it's this heroic story of a stand that these farmers made against this brilliant and great general, and these Italian farmers won. It's a historically in Italy, it was a great moment in their history.
And you shot it in Italy?
Yes, I do a lot of in Romania in Italy. I do a lot of work with the Italians. I've been doing it for ever since before Amadeus, actually. It's kind of my second home.
And you got the...
this picture I'm doing now is part Italian. It's Italian and Canadian financed.
This one is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The one I'm working on. And Barbarossa was strictly Italian.
Oh, I see.
And that was the fifth film I made with that director. And I'm going to make another one with him next year in Italy and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
That, too, is a co-production between Canada and Italy. Don't ask me the connection, but there it is.
It's all right. I remember going, my family and I went to Stratford, and there was the Canadian-Chinese restaurant. Whatever it takes. What's the picture you're working on now?
This is Giancarlo Giannini, and I are old friends.
Ah.
He wrote this script for us, and he's starring in it and directing it as well, and we're shooting it just outside of Toronto. I'm in town for only about 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
I had a break and I came here to be with the family. But we're shooting up there, and then we'll when we finish up in Toronto, we'll go back to Rome and finish up there.
I have
to be done with the picture on the end of October.
What's the title?
It's several titles. It feels a little like Woody Allen, you know, the X Project.
Or untitled Woody Allen.
It's called... Looking in Obituaries.
Yeah, it's going to be renamed in the States.
It's a good script. He did well. He wrote it, too.
Cool.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's an inventor, too, by the way. Anyway.
What did he invent?
He is an electronic genius.
Really?
He does inventions for his own house, for his own sound system. And it's a remarkable man. He really is, aside from being a... remarkable ladies' man. They just fall over their feet when they see him. He's had a wonderful career. That his work with Lena was just sensational.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Ruth Mueller.
Yes.
I worked with her on a picture that she wrote.
What was the picture?
It was called, let's see, Enough About Romance, Now Let's Have Some Sausages. I mean, that's what she writes. But it was my co-star was Sophia Loren,
and she
played my wife, lover, and I got to kiss her a lot of times.
Wow! You wish Kubrick was directing that day?
Yeah.
Take 130.
I don't know if I understand Kubrick's last flick. I was very disappointed, and I'm a real big fan.
Eyes Wide Shut. I was with it until the third Last Warning.
I just thought this is becoming predictable and dull. And he's never dull.
No.
I mean, his early stuff is still great. The Killing is still
love
great.
The Killing. It's so funny when people, I show that to people, and I think they're used to the wide, huge, you know, almost bleak scope of something like The Shining in 2001. But, oh, The Killing is so good.
Yeah.
Great heist film. Now you got me thinking of Sterling Hayden, and I'm interviewing you.
Sterling Hayden, wow. Continues to churn it out, doesn't he?
Mm, always timeless work. It's funny,
have you seen... my wife discovered it recently. The original upon which, speaking of Sterling Hayden, Airplane was based?
In
The Zone? Or what was it?
I thought there were a couple.
Zero Hour.
Zero Hour, yes.
Have you seen it?
Not in a long time.
Oh, man, suddenly it's so funny.
So... the Zuckers really were taking notes watching that.
No, they were lifting lines. The names are the same, too.
Oh, really?
At one point, Sterling Hayden say, it's a fine time to quit smoking. That was his line originally. And he's very serious. I mean, of course, they're all very serious. But it's great. I mean, you got to see it.
I'll look for it because it was funny. That was 1980, and when the airplane came out.
Oh, that couldn't have
out.
Been that late, really?
No, airplane. Yeah.
Oh, airplane. Yeah.
Yeah, airplane. But what I mean was, you had all these serious actors like Leslie Nielsen and Lloyd Bridges and Robert Stack, and they were able to get a second wind of their careers doing that stuff.
Well, they were willing to make fun of themselves. I thought that was very bold, and also that the credit goes to the director for making them feel they can get away with it. I think that was they were wonderful. Bridges was sensational.
Yep.
But there was another line, the doctor on the plane. It was legitimate. It was so funny.
I speak jive, no.
You have to find a doctor, but a doctor who didn't eat fish.
Oh, right.
It's an honest to God, anyway.
Hey, let's not forget about your tongue work in Loaded Weapon 1.
That could have been better. Anyway, that's always fun.
A few months ago, I actually found on DVD and bought and watched again Name of the Rose.
Ah, yeah.
Very scary in that, you are.
6 months shooting. Sean was terrific.
That was the first of two times working with Sean.
Yeah, he's a good guy. At least he was with me, anyway.
That's good.
Yeah, we got along very well. I usually have trouble with anyone, but, you know, you can't get along with everyone.
Mm-mm.
Some people are impossible, and we won't even go into who they are. Okay?
I would never ask that. That's not this is not that type of program. Yeah. Just one film fan to another. I just
don't understand why we can't make better films. I really don't. I mean, we've got all these examples for the last, I don't know how many years now. There's no excuse for this crap. You know, there really isn't. There's just no respect for the word, I think, and that's what the problem is. Enough of this slice-of-life action crap. Let's get some art back into it. You know, those wonderful moments when you hear a theme or you see even a few frames of a picture and you go, I want to watch this again. I can't wait to see this movie again. That's the kind of movie that we can still make. I mean, the idea that you have to spend $200 million for a picture and you still can't make anything but trash, it's absurd.
Do you get a lot of offers from, say, independent directors?
Well, I get them. It's just that even that, they're not very good. I'd love to work for Del Toro, for example.
Ooh.
He and I got along very well on Mimic. Mm-hmm. And we made promises, and I'm from the border of Mexico, and we both speak Spanish, and I just haven't heard from him. So I'm sure when something comes up, he'll call me, because he's a sincere man. But I think he's terrific, and he started out as an independent. What was that wonderful story from Buñuel when he was approached? Do you remember that picture that Woody Allen made where they're standing in line and he talks, having an argument?
Annie Hall.
And Marshall McLuhan.
Marshall McLuhan is back behind the plant, If Life Were Only Like This.
Yes, well, he originally wanted Buñuel to do that.
Oh, really?
And it was going to be a different conversation, but it was going to... And he offered, you know, he offers everyone the same money, take it or leave it. But for Buñuel, who said, I can't do it, I'm busy, I'm working. And he said, well, I'll give you such and such amount of money. And he went up to $30,000, and which is outrageous for Woody Allen to offer.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a wealth of money for him to offer. And Buñuel still said, I really can't do it. And then he reflected and said, that was more money than my last film cost me to make. $30,000. Well, you're shooting in Mexico at the time. But
sure.
The point is, it doesn't have to be an expensive film to be a good one. You need a script. You need some good actors. And if you got a good script, you're going to get the actors.
Mm-hmm.
You get me just in a second. But anyhow, you do work for free. I mean, my theater work is practically, I have to underwrite it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Theater doesn't pay.
Oh, we know about underwriting here. This interview,
you know very well what I'm talking about.
This interview was made possible by memberships like yours. Thank you.
Love. I got no complaints. But I really think that, as I said before, I've got a lot of friends in this business, so that long, long-lived friends who are just brilliant actors with all these chops, and they can't get arrested. I have to keep reminding them and myself what luck means in our lives. And I'm a very proud actor. I really love my profession, but I'm also full of humility. I'm constantly grateful for these breaks I've been getting. And I'm absolutely sincere when I tell you that.
Well, I looking back at even the film work, there doesn't seem to be anything that is embarrassing. And I've seen people with lots of money and lots of acclaim, and they do something that's just, it's just downright silly and not in a complimentary way. And that I don't think it's ever happened with you.
Keep talking. And you're very nice. Thank you so much for this.
And that was me with F. Murray Abraham. This is Film Sociology. I'm your host, Matthew Sosi, reviewing some of the interview highlights from the first season of Film Sociology. Here I am with Indiana actor and Guillermo del Toro's favorite contortionist in the mail department. Here's my chat with Doug Jones. So, just so everybody knows, on the record, I'm talking to Doug in Paris. Well, Doug's in Paris. I'm here in Indianapolis. What are you working on over there, my friend?
Well, I am here in Paris, France, working on a movie called Serge Gainsbourg, Vie Héroïque, which means a life heroic. It is a biography on the life of singer-songwriter icon in the French culture, Serge Gainsbourg. And I'm playing a fantasy element in the film. I'm like an alter ego sort of fantasy character that only exists for him. He sees me, hears me, talks to me, and no one else can.
So this is riding the La Vie en Rose success wagon?
I'm sure. Sure. Well, actually, the French have been making movies for a long time, though, I hear.
No, really? About musicians?
Yeah.
Get out.
They might have even started it. I'm not sure.
Wow. We'll have to work on that.
I know, right? But it's being... The fun thing about this one is that I'm wearing a big makeup again that makes me look like someone that I'm not, and it's being applied by, it was created by the DDT Effectos Especiales. That's the team that brought you the Fawn from Pan's Labyrinth, and also the Pale Man from Pan's Labyrinth. So I've worked with them before.
It's got to be nice to have a rapport with a group like that. It must be easier as far as application and working relations.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like getting together with old friends. I love them dearly, and I trust them. And you know what? When you're in a makeup chair for 5 hours at a time, the people who are you've entrusted to, yourself to their hands, it's important that you do trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And we do get along really well, and they're kind of like nurse. It's like I become a nursing home patient because I can't see or hear for myself. I can feel very little. And so these people are more than just makeup artists. They're also caregivers, you know.
What do you do in the 5 hours? Because the most I've ever had to sit in the makeup chair was 45 minutes, and I thought I was going to rip my hair out.
Yeah, I know. Well, I get asked this a lot, but I'm not even sure. I think I'm really good at zoning out. I do fall asleep a lot. If there's a headrest, I'm we're all screwed. We'll listen to music. We might even pop open a laptop and watch silly things on YouTube, talk and tell stories, of course. You know, I don't know.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Now, I'm looking at here, you're a Bishop grad.
Bishop Chittard High School, yes.
And in Ball State.
Back in 1978.
That's not a curse word. It's okay.
Okay.
Now, so you studied theater at Ball State as well as telecommunications. Now, I have to ask, because this is a Wikipedia thing. I had it. Mime and contortionist?
Oh, does Wikipedia have that all listed?
Yes,
really?
Yes, it does. I say,
well, you know, they are the encyclopedia.
And you would have been very popular at Ball State if you had both of those in your system.
I was doing all that at Ball State, and yes, I was popular. I can put both my legs behind my head, and it's actually come in very handy over the years, especially when I was doing a lot of TV commercials at the beginning of my career. If they needed some kind of a sight gag or something, we need something physical, something funny, and in an audition, if I threw my leg over my head, it's like, well, that's it, pass him. So that was kind of an easy, that was my, but I'm a one-trick pony when it comes to contorting. I don't have a circus act.
You're not on the sideshow, no?
No. Okay, the mime thing started at Ball State University. My freshman year there, I joined a mime troupe called Mime Over Matter. You get it?
Dun, 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 dun.
Whap! So, but that actually was a very useful art form for me, as it turns out. I've always kind of been a talker with my hands as well as my mouth. And learning the art of mime, it really... really kind of woke up the storytelling senses that happened from the neck down. You know, body language tells so much of the story and gesturing and all of that. So when you're using an art form that doesn't use dialogue, verbal dialogue at all, you have to rely on all the physical dialogue. So that's kind of what was a great background for me to, you know, get into the kind of acting that I'm known for now, which is more of the creature effects, costume, fantasy characters.
You're the fantasy that guy.
Are you pointing right now?
Yeah, I pointed when I told people I was talking to you.
At Ball State, any theater that I did was either with the Mime Troupe, which was all physical, and I didn't do any plays that were the standard, you know, Chekhov or, you know, whatever, Shakespeare. That wasn't my thing.
Mm-hmm.
Standing and emoting, for doing monologues wasn't what I was. I never did it
back then. But Lear needed to throw his legs back behind his head, couldn't he?
As any good king would do, sure.
So after Ball State, where'd you go next?
Well, I went up to North Manchester, Indiana, and I'm lying to you. First stop was Kings Island in Cincinnati, Ohio, as a mime. I worked on the streets there of the theme park around the Eiffel Tower. Now, talk about coming full circle. Now I'm sitting here at a hotel where I can look out and see the Eiffel Tower, the real one.
Of course.
Here in Paris, yeah. So, and the Eiffel Tower in Cincinnati, though, at Kings Island, is about a third of the scale of this one. So seeing the real one is quite different.
Indeed.
And after that summer of 1982, it was up to North Manchester, Indiana, to work at a newspaper there as an advertising salesman. And I thought that I was going to slip my wrist because I was, you know, wearing a tie and being responsible is just not my thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, off to California to work at a bank as a management trainee. That was basically the excuse to get us out to California.
Right.
You know, by that time, I was married to the lovely Mrs. Lori.
Hello.
Also a Ball State graduate. Woo-hoo. In 1984. And we just we moved out to California in 85.
And how did you lead up to the Newly Deads?
Yeah.
Research.
Oh, my God. Well, thank you for bringing up the most embarrassing credit on my entire IMDb list.
That's the one?
I think that is by far. That was one of those straight-to-VHS releases, you know. I think it was 86 or 7, yeah.
But it's not going to make the transfer to DVD?
Oh, heck no. It made the whole movie for $1.75. It was shot on 16mm film. Oh, it's just so cheesy. Horribly written, horribly acted by all of us. I'm going to include myself. And but if you like low budget hideous horror movies, that's the one to see.
Maybe you'll be at Mystery Science Theater someday. Well, no, not anymore.
Oh no, it's great fun to watch to pop in the Newly Deads with a bunch of sarcastic, funny people sitting watching it because the dialogue of the film didn't even matter.
But isn't it true Tim Burton saw it and said brilliant, and then he casted you later on?
Yeah, that's how it went. No, you big silly. No, I met Tim Burton on Batman Returns. Actually, I was called into the stunt office because of the contortion thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I put my legs behind my head. One of the people on their stunt team knew of me and gave me a call just to come and. They could put me on videotape to you know, put my legs on. Because there was a circus theme to Batman Returns.
Right.
You know, the Penguin hung out with the Red Triangle Circus Gang. And so while I was there, the stunt coordinator saw what I did, and he said, hang on just a second. He went to the next room and brought Tim Burton back in with him and said, do what you just did for me. This is Tim Burton, the director. I'm like, hi, Tim. So, yeah, that was a wonderful break for me. One of many breaks over the years.
And I say, what's the percentage of acting jobs where you have and have not had to have lots of makeup?
Probably, it's about two-thirds of my work has been under heavy makeup, and about a whole third of it is with my own face.
Mm-hmm.
And this past year especially, I've aside from the movie I'm working on right now, the full year before this was all my own face. I did a guest starring gig on Criminal Minds that aired just in December before I came here. I did an episode of Fear Itself on NBC. It's a great horror show at night, like a one-hour anthology kind of show where every episode was like a Twilight Zone, a whole new story, whole new cast, all that.
Right.
And I've done other lots of other films in the meantime, one of which was filmed right there in Indiana at the Ball State campus and surrounding area in Muncie, Indiana, called My Name is Jerry. I played the title character of Jerry, a 40-something-year-old white guy going through his midlife crisis.
Wow, that,
which I could relate to, by the way, Matt.
It's a stretch. Really.
I'm pushing 50 now, so yes, no, I can relate.
That's a whole other stress. Well, not only do you, I was asking about the percentage, but also you get to actually act with other people for a change. Or do you, I mean, is it a lot of green and blue screen work for you?
Oh, no, no. I've always acted with other people on screen. I've never done motion capture, which is what you might be thinking of.
Okay.
You're wearing like a really green-colored leotard with dots all over it, and for the computer animators to have some movement.
Fun at parties.
Yeah. The leotard with dots on it, that
yep.
is fun. Especially when people have markers and they're connecting the dots, right?
Touché.
But I've never done that. I've always worn makeups, and there might be some CG enhancement later, such as happened with the Silver Surfer when I did the Fantastic Four sequel. Playing the Silver Surfer, I was in a makeup and costume every day that looked like the Silver Surfer. I was H.O.T. hot. Can I tell you that?
Yeah, and I was very impressed that you were able to dip your voice down to sound like Lawrence Fishburne.
Wasn't that great of me?
It was.
Actually, I wish you could have heard. I dipped my voice down to affect a Silver Surfer voice of my own that everybody told me was fantastic, including directors, producers, and my castmates. Jessica Alba loved my voice.
Really?
So,
tell me again, slowly.
Yes, she did. What's that?
Tell me again, slowly.
Slowly, I know. It's like, Jessica Alba really liked my low voice. But, of course, as marketing a multi-million dollar comic book franchise film like that, these studio execs were, you know, doing what marketing people do, which was to try to sell the film. And if getting, you know, Morpheus to voice the Silver Surfer, well, then, you know, then you get Lawrence Fishburne.
Fair enough. How did you meet up with Guillermo del Toro? Because you're now, I think you're one of the regular del Toro players.
You know, if there is such a thing as a regular del Toro player, I would be very honored to be included in it. I feel like I have been, yes. He's a very loyal type dog that way. If he finds people that he likes and trusts and works with well, he'll keep you in his pool of to be used again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I met him on Mimic back in 1997 when we were filming. I was called in at the last minute when they were doing reshoots in L.A. They filmed it up in Toronto. The problem was that when they were doing reshoots in L.A. for 3 days, the guy who played the Long John bug-like creature mm-hmm. up there in Toronto was also a tall, skinny guy, but he could not work in the States legally. So they had to come looking for someone that could, you know, pull on the bug man sort of slash costume. I was in every creature effects shop's Rolodex, you know, so let's call Doug Jones. I got a phone call at the last minute before a night shoot. And so that started a 3-day filming for me on Mimic. And Guillermo del Toro, that was his first time directing a large budget studio film in the United States. He'd filmed a lot of things independently in Mexico before that, including a movie called Kronos, which had lots of artistic acclaim and lots of critical appeal.
Really like Kronos.
So meeting him, I did not know, I wasn't aware of who he was when I met him, but here was this roly-poly, jolly, hysterically funny 8-year-old boy in a big man's costume, you know, that's what it felt like. And at lunchtime on the second day, he sat there with his chin in his hand, and he said, "So tell me all the movies you've been in." And he wanted to hear all about, you know, and I'm wearing half of a bug costume while I'm eating, and I'm like, what? So he wanted to know all the creatures I played. He loves monsters.
Mm-hmm.
It was like talking to a 9-year-old boy. So I told him, you know, I've been in this movie and that movie, and he said, "Oh, what makeup artist have you worked with?" So I told him all about Stan Winston, Rick Baker, Tony Gardner, Mike Elizalde. I went on doing all these names of people that have been, you know, Oscar winners, Greg Canham included.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, "Oh, I love his work. Who else?" So he was just kind of excited and bright-eyed. And I thought maybe he wasn't really the director of the film. Maybe a fanboy snuck in and took his place for him. Like, "Security!" But that's what was so endearing and lovable about him, is that he is a fanboy first. And you know, and so he directs and writes films that appeal to his fanboy senses. That's why he is a fanboy favorite.
Of the work you've done with him, of course, with Pan's Labyrinth and the two Hellboy films and Mimic, which was the most difficult to work on?
None of them are easy, but he's, you know, I think the motto with him is, it doesn't look good until it hurts Dougie.
It's on your business card, isn't it?
I think that's what I believe it's true. Well, I think for intellectually, it was very difficult for me to pull off the Fawn character in Pan's Labyrinth because I was in a 5-hour makeup and costume to get ready, clumping around on hoof feet. I couldn't sit back and recline all day because I had a tail sticking out of my butt, and I had ram horns on my head that didn't allow me to rest my head anywhere. That was tough, and adding to that the Spanish dialogue, I had to deliver paragraphs of important dialogue that was all the exposition of the film in Spanish. I don't speak Spanish, Matt.
Really?
No, but I did in that movie because I just memorized the dialogue. So that was a memorization nightmare. By the way, I'm doing that again on this French movie. I'm memorizing all this dialogue in French here.
Not Spanish.
It's going to dub over me later because my accent is completely wrong.
So when you get your awards, you obviously thank your makeup people and your chiropractor and your yoga instructor.
Yes, and God for keeping me alive one more day during every shoot. But, you know, I think when it comes to difficulty and pulling through, it was the Hellboy 2 shoot that was the one that almost killed me, I think. That was 6.5 months we were there in Budapest, and it was a 6-day work week. About 18 hours a day, and I had very few days off. Out of the 128-day filming schedule, I worked 108 of those days. So that meant 4 hours of sleep a night and falling asleep in makeup chairs constantly, and my skin, after being glued and cleaned up and glued and cleaned up and glued and cleaned up day after day, it really took a toll on me. And emotionally, too, it's a lot to bear through, but... But once I saw Hellboy 2, it became one of those movies that was, you know, a career marker for me. You know, the role of Abe Sapien was so wonderfully written and expanded this time. And in addition to that, I got to play the Angel of Death and the Chamberlain, these other two characters that are just, the Angel of Death especially, delicious.
And nice singing, by the way.
Oh, thank you. And you know what? The first time I heard Can't Smile Without You by Barry Manilow, whom I love and adore, and you do too, Matt, and don't lie and tell me you don't.
Na, 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 na,
everybody he loves Barry. Na, stop na, it. Na. Just shut up and accept it. So, Barry Manilow, Can't Smile Without You. When I was a senior in high school, that was on the radio in my kitchen at home, and I was like, yes! I would sing that song out loud and wonder why, you know, so... You know, girl X of the day didn't want to spend time with me, right? So it was brought that kind of high school puppy love experience full circle. There I am singing with Hellboy as we lament the loves in our lives and pop open a Tecate beer for the first time.
The day after the Oscars, did you have a dartboard of Brad Pitt?
Oh, no, of course not. There's love for Brad Pitt.
We all love each other.
There's all kinds of love. No. And the makeup artist, Greg Canham, who made up Kate Blanchett and Brad Pitt and took the Oscar home for that. He's a friend of mine. I worked with him on Hannibal and also a movie called, wait a minute, oh, with Kim Basinger. Oh, I played a demon. Okay,
Bless the Child.
Bless the Child.
Ooh.
Thank you. Woohoo!
Wow, that's why I'm here, folks, among other things.
Thank you.
What did you work with Rick Baker on?
Good note. I'm sorry.
What did you work with Rick Baker on?
Rick Baker, Men in Black Part 2.
Electric Boogaloo.
That's right. And then I did some test projects for him that never made it to film before that. He's one of those icons that we, you know, in that creature effects makeup business, everybody knows everybody. So when you see him walk in the room with his ponytail and those two shocks of white hair, you can't miss him.
And looking at your resume, you have a lot of cult films. I mean, which are of various degrees. First off, I love Pencilhead.
No, Mystery Men was a fun movie. That was one of those little cameos. I love doing cameos. You commit two or three days of your life and you're done.
You got that. I actually was one of nine people that saw Tank Girl in the theater, as well as Monkey Bone.
Oh. Listen, I had so much fun with these.
I know. That's why I'm taking them up. Okay, how mysterious was M. Night working on Lady in the Water?
Yeah, Lady in the Water, I was one of the Tartutic characters, which are those monkey-like creatures that came out of the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the one being that could overtake the wolf made out of grass. It was very nature-like a show.
Mm-hmm.
M. Night Shyamalan. It's funny. He's very iconic and he's huge, and he's celebrated and decorated as a director. He was to talk to him. He was just like somebody you would be really good friends with in college, I liked him a lot. I did like him a lot, and he was actually he has a reputation for being for being full of himself, but I found him to be very humble and very very easy to work with. He was very collaborative with us. But again, you've got guys in rubber suits that look like apes, and they're made out of tree bark. If we had a suggestion, he was going to listen to us, wasn't he?
Sure. Now, did you ever see the documentary Operation Filmmaker? I asked this because I was channel surfing and Doom came on.
No, I'm in it. I heard I'm in that.
Yeah, this kid didn't try to fleece you for money, I hope.
No, he did not. No.
Okay. if for those who are listening, there's a documentary called Operation Filmmaker. It's about a young lad who winds up working on a couple of films, including Doom. And, he's a loathsome character. At least that's what the documentary presents him as. So there you go.
Now, he was from either Iran or Iraq, right?
Right, and he got picked up because he did the Middle Eastern version of MTV, which should be fascinating. And
right.
And worked on Everything is Illuminated, and then later lost his visa and lent money and got money and worked on Doom, and The Rock was going to – I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson was going to pay him for his film school. And as the documentary went on, you just wanted to smash a guy in the face with a mallet.
I've never seen the whole thing. So you've seen the whole thing?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we had it at the film festival here in town last year.
Was that the Heartland Film Festival?
No, that was the International Film Festival.
Maybe My Name is Jerry can play there, since it's an Indiana local film even, right?
Now, yeah, it's possible. And was it you recently told me you were working on Super Capers?
Well, yes. In fact, this is the weekend to talk about it, because Super Capers, it's a superhero spoof movie. It's a comic book film spoof. And in it, I play a knockoff of Agent Smith from The Matrix, and I'm in three pivotal scenes, and it's going to be it has a selected city limited release this weekend, starting Friday, March 20th. Indianapolis is one of the chosen cities to give it this test run in, and if it does well this weekend, it will then open nationwide in a broader release. But it's all over Indianapolis. It's playing like in the Clearwater Crossing, Glendale Mall, Carmel, Noblesville. There's a website. If you go to the DougJonesExperience.com, which is my website.
That's your band, isn't it?
You have to say it in a low advertising voice like that. The DougJonesExperience.com.
It's your trio.
Yeah. If you go there. There'll be information up, clickable to take you to the official website for Super Capers. That'll have all the theaters listed.
Now, in your spare time, have you done the sci-fi conventions and hung out with that lot? And how's that work out?
It's funny because people ask me all the time if the sci-fi and comic book conventions are scary, and they're not. Actually, they're full of eccentric, colorful people, mind you. Yes. But this is a whole phenomenon that I didn't know much about until a couple of years ago, and I have an appearance manager now who specializes in these conventions. So I've done the whole circuit now. It's a great place to publicly and safely meet fans, people who have been buying tickets to go see movies I'm in over the years, buying the DVDs, renting things, tuning in when I'm on television, and when they come up to my table to look at the 8x10s I have there, or to have me sign something, or they bring in their DVDs or posters from home or whatever, it's just a great time to connect. And and get loved on. And I don't know who wouldn't like that, you know?
I'm sorry, loved on? What?
Loved on, Matt. Yes. You would be surprised. Well, see, I have a reputation for being something of a hugger, and this gets out there, and so I have many requests for hugs at my when people come up to me at the conventions, and it's great. It's great, Matt. Stop making fun of me.
I'm not making fun of you, but were you jealous of Billy Crudup's size in Watchmen?
I haven't seen Watchmen yet.
There's a nickname for the film, but I can't tell you on radio, so I'll save it.
Ooh, that sounds naughty.
It could be. Now, is it true, wrapping things up, is it true you've challenged Bill Irwin and Andy Serkis to, you know, handball matches?
First of all, I don't even know how to play handball. And second of all, I wouldn't challenge Bill Irwin or Andy Serkis to anything. I think they're both geniuses and fantastically wonderful. It looks like, and hopefully I'll get to work with and meet Andy Serkis, hopefully. Keep your fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm.
Unofficially, the word is out there that, you know, that Guillermo del Toro, of course, I mean, he is officially directing the Hobbit movies.
Right.
And but the unofficial part is my involvement. You know, he has said publicly into the press that he's got something for me in the film, but he won't commit to what that is yet out loud. So, or to me. So I don't have a clue what I'm doing or how many characters or when or if or any of that. So, but Andy Serkis and I both get interviewed and asked about each other all the time, so I cannot wait to meet him. And I think I think we're going to be picking each other's brains apart when we do.
Well, if you do,
in a good way. That sounded very cannibalistic.
Well, you did do Hannibal.
I did.
Well, if you meet Andy, tell him any person that holds Naomi Watts in the palm of his hand, it's all right by me.
Okay. Okay, I'll see. And I'll tell him to tune into WFYI. I'll tell him that for sure.
Doug, we really appreciate the time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And Super Capers this weekend. Woohoo!
Doug, can you do a station ID for me?
I can. Hey, this is Doug Jones, and you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI.
What Doug said. Okay, we have enough time for one more. We'll have to cut off the end of this, but here is my conversation with NPR's Linda Wertheimer. So, Linda, I'm curious. You're a very busy lady, but have you seen any movies lately? Old, new, indifferent?
Well, I go to the movies almost every Saturday night if I'm home.
Really?
We have this sort of standard movie date. My husband and I go to the movies with Cokie Roberts and her husband, Steve, and sometimes with Nina Totenberg and her husband, David Rines. When all of us are there, there are some limits as to what we do. I mean, Cokie does not go to see movies where people get blown up.
Okay.
So serious violence, we don't do serious violence.
All right.
My husband, Fred Wertheimer, does not go to movies with writing on them, if he can help it.
Oh, subtitles.
So, no subtitles.
So no Hong Kong action movies.
Uh-uh. And Nina does not like to go to movies. I mean, she also doesn't like violence, and she doesn't particularly like sad movies. And I draw the line at anthropomorphism. I cannot stand that. But that what that basically means is that we go to sort of date night chick flick kind of movies. I think the last one we went to together was Bright Star.
And did you enjoy it?
I loved it. Bright Star was
the Jane Campion film.
Jane Campion about Keats.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got home, I looked up Keats in my favorite book of poetry, 500 Top Poems, which I totally recommend to everyone. And almost everything, I think everything in the movie was in my book. So I was able to read it all. I loved it. I thought it was great. And she, she has such a genius, Jane Campion does, for those sort of super quiet, very powerful kinds of movies that don't kind of grab you by the throat. But
and a lot of people are saying this is her best work since The Piano.
I think that's right. I think that is right. I like The Piano, too.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I was curious, do you guys see stuff that's not endorsed by NPR? I mean, stuff other than Fox Searchlight, which we always hear during, but we appreciate it. But, I mean, I'm intrigued.
Well, there's we sometimes make decisions based on what Bob Mondello says.
Of
course.
You know,
who is the film critic.
Yeah, I'm familiar with him.
But he, he gives us... But, you know, he does like very serious movies, and we kind of don't.
have you ever gone to him at work and cuffed him in the back of the head on a glowing review that you didn't like, or vice versa?
No. I figure that it's on me. I went, but I don't think he, you know, he doesn't steer you wrong. He tells you what you're in for, and you just make the decision. Now, I personally like violence, and so when Cokie's not in town, my husband and I make a point to go see, you know, every horrible bang bang movie that we were unable to go to.
Is it a way of of therapeutic getting?
Maybe so. I just think that, you know, I like thrillers. I like in a sort of horrible way. I suppose it's escapist.
Mm-hmm.
Please God, it's not like my actual life where, you know, people might talk you to death, but they are not going to blow you up.
What are some of your favorite action films?
Well, I've enjoyed the new James Bond ones with Mr. Craig. I mean, mm-hmm. I know that they're not quite as good as some of the James Bond movies, but he's very good, it seems to be.
Well, it's a reminder that if you read the novels, Bond was borderline sadist.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I think that was kind of lost with the last few gentlemen.
Yes, but I also think that borderline sadist, borderline racist. I mean, you don't want those movies to be
translated
directly. That can't happen in the modern world.
That's true. That is true.
But I would say that I tend to sort of follow actors, and of course some actors are more likely to be in action movies than others, but, you know, like Tommy Lee Jones is a big favorite of mine.
Cool.
George Clooney is a big favorite. My husband, now the guy, all the movies that before and after Fargo. You know,
the Coen Brothers?
Yeah, we're big Coen Brothers fans.
Have you seen their latest?
Cokie, no, we have not, because Cokie hasn't been out of town. But that's on our list. It's on our short list of movies to go to.
So you mentioned the Coens and you mentioned Tommy Lee Jones. I have to ask about No Country for Old Men.
We were there. I was there. As I recall, I don't think we all saw it together. I think Fred and I went to that one, mm-hmm. but. I thought that was a very good movie.
You grew up in Texas. How was
New Mexico?
New Mexico.
On the edge of Texas.
Exactly. Sorry. How was the representation as far as that area? Because
it was spot on. I mean, my mother lived on a street. You know that funny scene where you're driving down a street in a West Texas town where all of the houses are single story, and there's a sort of sense of this giant amount of sky overhead and about 50 million cars parked in front of each house.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it is. I mean, that's it. Everybody's got their truck. And, I mean, it might have been the street my mother lived on in Odessa.
Did you see the film that Jones directed, The Three Burials of Mikitas Estrada?
Yes, indeed.
I thought that was the best film that year.
It was a very good film, and he was very good in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's wonderful.
It reminded me of, because that I think that film worked for a few different things. It was the hostage and, you know, the taker and the takee's story, the redemption story, and a little bit of a revenge and the morality tale.
Mm-hmm,
and I think
mm-hmm.
all of them work brilliantly.
And the whole idea that that he was. That it in the end it turned out to be some giant fantasy that he was that he was attempting to deal with. It was just a very good film. Now I'm a big fan of his, as I said. Although I have to say that, you know, he does in that movie and in some of his more recent movies, he really looks like such a rough customer lately.
Well, I'm sure that's part of the appeal.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think he looks like anything else. I mean, he's not exactly a debonair person.
No, and it's so funny.
No George Clooney, he. No, but then that's why we like him.
And I know George has got two films coming out.
Stares at Goats. Now,
yeah.
I want to see that. And I understand nothing about that movie, and I haven't read anything about it. But just watching the trailers, I got to go.
How have you liked Clooney as a director?
You know, I don't really know enough about film to say. I'm not sure that I would know the difference. But usually, I think I'm one of those people who notices when a film is badly done.
Sure.
But when it's well done, I couldn't tell you why.
And that was my chat with Linda Wertheimer from NPR. Of course, before that, Doug Jones, and before that, F. Murray Abraham. Thanks to everybody who has been a part of Film Sociology for Season 1. Special thanks to Melissa Davis, Jim Mueller, and, of course, the staff here at WFYI. And to you, the listeners, especially those who go to WFYI.org and msoci at WFYI.org, and, of course, on Facebook. Next week will be my year in review, the best and worst of 2009, with Ed Johnson at Nuvo.